Chapter 5. Pitt stood under the shower nozzle, the steaming hot water opening his pores. After finishing under a heavy spray of cold water, he stepped out, toweled, and shaved the stubble from the night before, taking his time. He hadn't the slightest intention of arriving at Hunter's headquarters on time. "Mustn't spoil the old bastard my first day on the job," he thought, grinning in the mirror. He decided on a white suit with a pink shirt. As he went through the intricacy of tying his tie, it occurred to him that it might not be a bad idea to carry a little protection. Summer had failed, but nevertheless, Pitt began to see the odds of his living to a ripe old age fade with each passing hour. He wasn't about to compete in hand-to-hand combat with highly trained professional intelligence agents. The Mauser, Model 712 Snell Feuer Pistol, serial number 47405, could only be described as a positively bloodthirsty firearm. It was a unique handgun due to its ability to fire one shot at a time or automatically like a machine gun. It was the perfect weapon to induce terror into any poor unfortunate who found himself gazing helplessly into its muzzle. Pitt casually tossed the gun onto the bed and reached into the suitcase again, retrieving a wooden shoulder holster. The narrow end had a metal railing that slid on a notch in the broomstick-styled grip, converting the gun into a carbine for long-distance targets. It also served as a grasp when firing on full automatic. Pitt then inserted the gun into the holster and, along with a 50-shot clip, wrapped the ugly killing machine in a beach towel. Before the elevator reached the lobby, it obediently halted at every other floor to take on new passengers until it could hold no more. Pitt wondered to himself what thoughts his fellow riders might entertain if they'd had any inkling of what he carried under the towel. After the throng bumped shoulders as they spilled into the lobby, Pitt remained and punched the panel button marked B and rode down to the basement parking area. He unlocked the AC Cobra, shoved the Mauser into a narrow space behind the driver's seat, and climbed in behind the wheel. He eased the car up the exit ramp and joined the traffic flow of Kalakaua Avenue, aiming its blunt snout toward the northern end of the city. The palm trees lining the street leaned their arched trunks over the block-long rows of contemporary-designed shops and offices, while the sidewalks snaked in a dense moving column of tourists dressed in brightly colored shirts and dresses. The sun was strong, and the savage glare bounced off the asphalt, causing Pitt to squint before he groped over the narrow dashboard for his sunglasses. He was already over an hour late for his meeting with Hunter, but there was something he had to do, some small hunch in the back of his brain that begged for a chance to be heard. He didn't quite know what he expected to find as the tires crunched the red volcanic pebbles that lined the driveway, but he had driven 2 miles out of his way, and there was no reason not to see it through. He parked the car and walked past a small, neatly carved sign that read, "Bernice Pauahi Bishop Museum of Polynesian Ethnology and Natural History." The main hall, with its balconies circling the upper levels, was crowded with neatly spaced exhibits of outrigger canoes, stuffed fish and birds, replicas of primitive grass huts, and strange, ugly carvings of ancient Hawaiian gods. Pitt spotted a tall, white-haired, proudly erect man, arranging a collection of shells in a glass case. George Papa'aloa had the true Hawaiian look, the wide brown face, the jutting chin, large lips, misty brown eyes, and a graceful way of effortlessly moving his body. He looked up, and recognizing Pitt, he waved. "Ah, Dirk, your visit makes my day one of joy. Come into my office where we can sit down." Pitt followed him into a neat Spartan office. The furniture was ancient, but refinished in a varnished sheen, and the books lining the walls were free of dust. Papa'aloa sat down behind the desk and motioned Pitt toward a Victorian settee. "Tell me, my friend, have you discovered King Kamehameha's final resting place?" Pitt leaned back. "I spent the better part of last week diving along the Kona coast and found nothing that resembled a burial cave." "Our legends say he was placed in a cavern beneath the water. Maybe it was one of the rivers." "You know better than I, George, that during the dry season your rivers are nothing more than dry gulches." Papa'aloa shrugged. "Perhaps it is best that his burial place is never found and that his remains lie in peace." "No one wants to disturb your king. There is no treasure involved. Kamehameha the Great would be a great archaeological find, nothing more. And instead of some damp old cave, his bones would rest in a fine new tomb in Honolulu, revered by all." Papa'aloa's eyes looked sad. I wonder if our great king would appreciate being gawked at by you Howleys. I think he could tolerate us mainland Howleys if he knew that 80% of his kingdom was now populated by Orientals. Sad, but true. What the Japanese failed to take with bombs in the 40s, they took with cash in the 70s and 80s. Someday it wouldn't surprise me to get up and see the rising sun waving in the trade winds over the Iolani Palace. Papa Loa looked at Pitt steadily, his face expressionless. There isn't much time left for my people. 2, maybe 3 generations, and we will be totally melted into the other races. My heritage dies with me. I am the last of my family with pure Hawaiian blood. He waved his arm around the room. That's why I have made this place my life's work, to preserve the culture of a dying race, my race. Papa'aloa stopped, gazing off vacantly out a small window at the Ko'olau Mountains. My mind wanders more as I get older. Now then, you didn't come here to hear an old man ramble on. What's on your mind? I want to know something about an area of the sea called the Pacific Vortex. Ah, yes, I know the place you mean. He looked thoughtful for a few moments and then spoke softly, almost in a whisper. Akamakani hemapa, kamauna okanole ikea, akanaka ke kauahiwi hoopi. Hawaiian is a very musical tongue, Pitt said. Papa Loa nodded. That's because it has only 7 consonants. H, K, L, M, N, P, and W. There can be no more than 1 consonant to a syllable. Translated in English, the poem means, when the south wind blows, the mountain of Kanoli is seen, and the summit seems peopled. Kanoli? Pitt asked. A mythical island to the north. According to legend, many centuries ago, a family tribe left the islands far to the southwest, probably Tahiti, and traveled in a large canoe across the great ocean to join other tribesmen who had immigrated to Hawaii decades before. But the gods were angry at the people's flight from their homeland. So they changed the position of the stars, causing the navigator of the canoe to lose his way. They missed Hawaii by traveling many miles to the north, where they sighted Kanoli and landed there. The gods had truly punished the tribe, for Kanoli was a barren island with few coconut and fruit trees, taro plants, and no cool, clear streams of pure water. The people made sacrifices and cried out to the gods for forgiveness. Their pleas went ignored, so the people threw off their cruel gods and worked very hard under the harshest of obstacles to make Kanoli a garden. Many died in the attempt, but after several generations, the people of Kanoli had built a great civilization out of the volcanic rock of the island. And, pleased at their accomplishment, they proclaimed themselves as their own gods. Pitt said, "Sounds like the trials of our pilgrims, Quakers, and Mormons." Papa'aloa uttered a long, negative sigh. Not the same. Your people kept their religion as a staff to lean on. The natives of Kanoli saw themselves as better than the gods they had once worshipped. After all, had they not built a paradise without them? They had overstepped the bounds of mortals. They began to raid Kauai, Oahu, Hawaii, and the other islands, killing and pillaging, taking the fairest of women back as slaves. The primitive Hawaiians were helpless. How could you fight men who acted and fought like gods? Their only hope was their faith in their own deities. They prayed for deliverance, and they were heard. The gods of the Hawaiians caused the sea to rise up and bury the evil Kanolians forever. My people also have a similar legend of a land being swallowed by the sea. It was called Atlantis. I've read of it. Plato describes it quite romantically in his Timaeus and Critias. It seems you're an authority on myths other than Hawaiian. Papa'aloa smiled. Legends are like knots on a string. One leads to another. I could tell you of tales handed down through the centuries in many faraway lands that are very nearly identical to, but predate, those of the Christian Bible. Clairvoyants predict Atlantis will rise again. The same is said of Kanoli. I wonder, Pitt muttered, how much truth lies behind the legend. Papa'aloa leaned his elbows on the desk and gazed at Pitt over clasped hands. Strange, he said slowly. Most strange. He used the same words. Pitt looked up questioningly. He? Yes, it was a long time ago. Right after World War II. A man came to the museum every day for a week and studied every book and manuscript in our library. He was also researching the legend of Cannoli. There must have been others through the years who found the story interesting. No, you are the first since the other. You have a razor-sharp memory, my friend, to recall someone that far back. Papa'aloa unclasped his hands and stared at Pitt hesitantly. I never forgot the incident simply because I never forgot the man. You see, he was a giant with golden eyes. Beyond puzzlement lies frustration, the neutralizing cloud hiding the next move. When a man enters that cloud, he is a man outside himself, a man who moves and acts instinctively. It was in such a state that Pitt found himself half an hour before noon, minutes after leaving George Papa'aloa at the museum. His mind was confused, shifting gears back and forth, trying desperately to piece the first two parts of the puzzle together. An old gray Dodge truck pulled out of the museum's parking lot and followed close behind. Pitt was ready to dismiss the trailing truck as fantasy. His subconscious was beginning to see enemy agents complete with trench coats and beady eyes lurking behind every clump of philodendron. But as he drove toward Pearl Harbor, the truck stayed with him around every corner as if tied by a rope. Pitt made another turn and increased his speed slightly, his eyes now on the rearview mirror. The truck also turned, lagged a bit, and then accelerated, closing the gap to its previous position. Pitt snaked the AC through traffic for 2 miles and then swung onto Mount Tantalus Drive. He drove smoothly around the hairpin curves that curled up the fern-forested mountainside of the Ko'olau Range, gradually pushing the gas pedal a millimeter closer to the floor with each turn. Glancing in the mirror, he studied the driver of the truck who was fighting with the wheel in a fanatical attempt to stay with the elusive little red car. Then the unexpected happened. With no telltale warning of a blasting report, a bullet smacked into the side-view mirror on the door, shattering the tiny circular glass and then passing through. The game was getting rough. Pitt stomped on the accelerator and put some distance between him and the pursuing Dodge. The son of a bitch was using a silencer, Pitt cursed silently. It had been a stupid move driving out of town. He'd have been relatively safe in downtown traffic. Now his only hope was to get back to Honolulu before the next shot took the top of his head off. With a little luck, he might happen onto a cruising police car. But Pitt was stunned by the next glance in the mirror. The truck had pulled to within 10 yards of the AC's bumper. The road reached the 2,000-foot crest and started the sharp descent in a series of meandering arcs to the city below. Pitt roared onto a mile-long straightaway, and the truck made an effort to close. Pitt held his speed constant in readiness for the next corner, crouching as low as the confining interior of the AC would allow. The needle on his speedometer was touching 75 as the pursuing driver crossed the center line of the road and pulled abreast. Pitt shot a look out the window. He never forgot the picture of the black, long-haired man who grinned back at him through irregular tobacco-stained teeth. It was only a flicker in time, but Pitt saw every detail of the pockmarked face, the black, burning eyes, the huge hooked nose covered by swarthy walnut skin. All Pitt could feel was frustration. Frustration at not being able to shoot back, to blow that bastard's face to pieces. He had a perfectly good machine gun resting behind his seat not 10 inches away, and he couldn't even reach it. A contortionist, 4 feet tall, might have been able to get his hands on the Mauser's grip, but not 6-foot-3-inch Pitt. The next option was to simply stop the car, get out, lean back in, and grab the gun from behind the seat, unwrap the towel that covered it, pop off the safety, and begin firing. The only problem was the timing. The old truck was too close. The hook-nosed driver could have stopped his truck and pumped 5 shots into Pitt's guts before he'd even reached the towel-unwrapping stage. The road ahead swept sharply to the left into a dangerous hairpin corner marked by a yellow sign whose black letters proclaimed, "Slow to 20." Pitt drifted through the curve at 55. The truck couldn't handle the centrifugal pull and lost ground, dropping back momentarily before the driver called on his ample supply of horsepower. Plan after plan shot through Pitt's mind, each new one discarded along with the ones before. Then, as he braked for the next corner, he began to apply still heavier pressure to the accelerator while watching the rearview mirror, studying the movements of the truck's driver as he began to pull even with the AC once more. It was small consolation that the man was not aiming a gun at Pitt's cranium. He meant to force Pitt off the road, over a steep cliff that fell several hundred feet to the valley below. Another 200 yards and they would meet the next curve, yet Pitt maintained his speed. The gray Dodge inched closer to the sports car's front fender. One final nudge and Pitt would be airborne. Then, with only 100 more yards to go, Pitt mashed the accelerator down hard, held it, and suddenly let up and braked. The abrupt maneuver caught the grinning stalker off guard. He had also increased his speed, attempting to stay even with his quarry, working again toward the position that would send Pitt hurtling over the cliff edge. Too late. They were on the curve. Pitt kept braking hard. He downshifted and threw the car around the bend, the tires shrieking in frictional protest across the pavement. The AC was in a four-wheel drift, the back end beginning to break away. A quick twist to the right and the skid was compensated, and then, accelerating again, Pitt shot onto the next straight. A glance in the mirror showed that the road behind him was empty. The great truck had vanished. He slowed down, relying on gravity and momentum to carry the car for the next half mile. Still no sign of the truck. Cautiously, Pitt spun a U-turn and drove back toward the curve, ready to crank another 180-degree turn if the old Dodge should suddenly come into sight. He reached the curve, stopped the car, and got out, walking to the edge of the road. The dust far below was settling very slowly upon the tropical underbrush. At the bottom of the drop, just beyond the base of the steep-sided cliff, the remains of the great truck lay with its engine torn from the frame. The driver was nowhere to be seen. Pitt had almost given up searching when he spotted an inert form high on a telephone pole about 100 feet to the left of the wreckage. It was a grisly sight. It looked as though the driver had tried to leap clear before the old Dodge began its flight over the precipice. He'd missed the edge and had fallen, tumbling through the air for nearly 200 feet before he struck a telephone pole perched in a concrete base. The body was impaled on a metal foot spike used by telephone repairmen for line maintenance. As Pitt stood entranced, the bottom section of the pole slowly turned from brown to red, as if painted by some unseen hand, like a flank of beef hanging on a meat hook. Pitt drove down Mount Tantalus, past the Manoa Valley lookout, until he reached the nearest house. He went up onto the vine-covered porch and asked an elderly Japanese woman if he might use her telephone to report the accident. The woman bowed endlessly and motioned Pitt to a phone in the kitchen. He dialed Admiral Hunter first, quickly relating the story and giving the location. The Admiral's voice came over the receiver like an amplified bullhorn, forcing Pitt to hold the blast a few inches from his ear. "Don't call the Honolulu police," Hunter bellowed. "Give me 10 minutes to get our security men on the wreckage before the local traffic investigators foul up the area. You got that?"
"I think I can manage it."
"Good," Hunter went on without touching on Pitt's sarcasm. 10 minutes, then move your tail out to Pearl Harbor. We've got work to do." Pitt acknowledged and hung up. Pitt waited 10 minutes, answering a multitude of questions about the crash, shot in rapid fire by the little Oriental woman. Then he picked up the phone again and asked the operator for the Honolulu police. When the gravel-throated voice requested his name after he volunteered the location, he said nothing and quietly replaced the receiver in its cradle. He thanked the owner of the house and backed away into the safety of his car. He sat there behind the wheel for a good 5 minutes, sweating from the humidity of the tropical heat and the unyielding leather of the bucket seat. Something didn't gel. Something he'd missed came back to tug at his mind, some line of thought that couldn't be translated. Then suddenly he had it. He started the car quickly and left twin streaks of Goodyear rubber on the worn asphalt as he sped back toward the wreck site. 5 minutes to the telephone, 20 minutes spent dawdling as though time meant nothing, 3 minutes back, 28 minutes in all, wasted. He should have guessed there'd be more than one of them on his trail. The AC skidded to an abrupt stop, and Pitt ran once more to the edge of the drop. The wreckage was just as he'd left it, all twisted and torn like a child's smashed toy. The telephone pole was as he'd left it, too, standing forlornly in the center of the palisade, its crossbars clutching wires that stretched off into infinity. The foot spikes were still there, too. But the driver's body had disappeared. Only the red stain remained, clotting and crystallizing under the onslaught of the morning sun.